My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Firstly, I just wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who's downloaded an episode in August. We've easily had our best ever month across all platforms and were stunned by the response. It really means the world to us and we hope you continue to enjoy the show. Thank you once again. My guest today is one of the most well-known and prodigious paranormal investigators in the UK. With over 40 years' experience investigating UFOs, chasing ghosts, and searching for Nessie, Malcolm Robinson will chase anything down to get to the truth. We have a great conversation about his career and discuss some notable cases from a variety of phenomena. Just before we dive in, don't forget you can follow us on Facebook, Podbean, subscribe to us on YouTube, and we're also on Twitter and Instagram as Mystery Monsters. Though on Instagram we're usually having meme wars with the ghost story guys, so if that's not your thing, we're probably not the best thing to follow. Right, now it's time for Malcolm Robinson.
My guest today has been investigating strange phenomena for over 40 years and has turned his keen eye and sharp mind to a variety of Fortean subjects. From UFOs to the Loch Ness Monster, more ghosts and hauntings than you can shake a stick at, Malcolm Robinson is one of the UK's leading investigators and authors. Malcolm, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters today.
Hello there, Paul. It's great to be a guest on your show. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Malcolm, I mean, as I touched on into the introduction there, you've been investigating these collections of weird events across a range of phenomena for what seems like decades. What was it that made you take the plunge to dive into these subjects and get involved?
Well, basically, like I've said many times before, it's always been a fascination for me, all these things, you know, the ghost supporter guys, UFOs. I grew up reading all the kind of fictional books on ghosts, and then as I progressed, I went, well, this is not what I want. You know, they're meant to be real. So I started buying books which claimed to contain real ghost stories. I started to read the works of Eric Van Daniken. And then I slowly but surely got myself embroiled in these wonderful subjects. But like I've said to many audiences when I give lectures, I was still very, very sceptical, Paul. I honestly felt there were no validity to any of these claims, and I was going to set out on a one-man crusade to try and disprove all these things. Yeah. But it's like anything else in life, you know, once you've actually spent the time, you've done the groundwork, you've spent nights in haunted houses, you've been out in the moors watching, looking for UFOs, things slowly began to change. I began to realise that, yes, whilst there is a lot of rubbish out there, absolutely there is, absolutely. Within all that quagmire, within all that noise, if you like, there's still a semblance of some real factual cases which demand explanation. And I guess to answer your question, probably it would be, I mean, I had my own experiences as a child, which we can maybe talk about later. So those helped propel me along the road, so to speak. But for me, possibly to answer your question, it would certainly have to be the Bob Taylor incident in 1979. Prior to that incident, I had a fascination for Nessie. And we did a lot of family visits to Inverness and Loch Ness. And that also captivated my young inquiring mind. I mean, and it is today, you know, one of my favourite books that I've written is all about Nessie, and I love that book because it really gets to grips with the enigma. But yeah, I mean, certainly it would be Bob Taylor. That case just really made me sit up, take notice, and went, wow, what's going on? What the hell's going on here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the Bob Taylor case has been one of those, I think, in UK 40 in history, is probably one of the most widely reported and well known. But I think the thing that gives that case something different to everything else is obviously the involvement of the police and the physical evidence and everything. It's just a baffling case, regardless of which side of the fence you're on. It's just extremely peculiar that what happened to that gentleman on that particular day.
It most certainly is, you know, and I mean, it's 40 years old this November, and I mean, I don't really like talking about the case these days, but I keep getting asked, you know, and because ufology should be all about being new cases. We want to hear new cases.
Yeah.
But the lovely Chris Evers asked me to do this talk at the in Pontefract for the Outer Limits conference, and because it now has some new theories, I felt it okay, let's talk about it, because it's adding, you know, we're adding to it all the time as the years roll by. People come up with new answers, explanations, and I suppose that the British public have a right to see how things have changed. But it's not, I like talking about it, but I would rather speak about new cases to an audience. But sometimes people demand, they want to hear these cases. It's like the Rolling Stones. They went to the concert. If they didn't play Honky Tonk Woman, they go, wow, you feel cheated, you know.
Yeah. Very so, true.
There's that to think about. But it's a case that certainly stands the test of time. You're quite right. It's the only case in Great Britain which has police investigation, forensic investigation on the case. The gentleman did not want this to happen in his life. He had no interest in UFOs at all. And yet, on that morning of November the 9th, 1979, his whole world was thrown upside down as he just walked into a scenario which was totally, and let's be honest about it, it was totally out of this world, and it was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that always struck me about Bob and his wife was that they were very down to earth, salt of the earth people. They were, you know, they weren't prone to flights of fantasy. They had no real interest in, as you say, in this subject whatsoever. And I always find stories that involve people who have zero interest in ufology or anything of that matter rather more compelling, I think, because of their innate scepticism to the whole. They had zero interest in any of that subject.
Yeah, that's very true. And a lot of people will just be suddenly thrown into this scenario. You know, that they're not looking for it in their life. And there's many cases worldwide of people out for a late night drive or just walking in the woods or whatever, and just encountering things that they didn't expect. Bob was just an ordinary guy. You know, he served over in France with the British Army. He was a tank driver during the war. He was over in France in D-Day 5. He liberated Belsen concentration camp. And after the war, he settled at a wee place called Pitlochry in Scotland, after which he moved to Livingston, Newtown in 1964. He became a foreman forestry worker there. And so, all he wanted really was just his pint, you know, down the bowling club, read the paper, go out with his mates. UFOs, what a load of rubbish. Who believes in that stuff? And yet, you know, as I say, his life changed. But for those listeners, and I'm sure there's not many, but for those listeners who don't know the story, on the morning of November the 9th, he was walking down a forestry path, and his job was to ensure that no cattle or sheep strayed into the woods got lost. And as he walked down the path, he came upon a clearing in the woods, and there he saw probably about 50 to 100 feet in the air above this area, a domed-shaped craft with a flange going around its perimeter. Coming up from the flange was cross-like projections. the object, whatever it was, started to disappear and reappear, disappear, reappear. He could see the young trees in the background. His dog was frantically barking because he had his dog with him that day. Bark, bark, barking at this object. And then suddenly what resembled two Second World War sea mines descended from beneath this craft, whatever it was, hit the ground and rolled towards him and stopped and projected his rod-like projections on his trousers, pulling him very, very forcibly towards this larger object. And he remembers a horrible smell in the area, a burning, pervading smell, like burning brake linings. There was a swishing sound in the air, and he lost consciousness. When he regained consciousness, the larger object was gone, the smaller objects were gone, and there were over 40 depressions, marks in the grass. He managed to struggle to his pickup truck. He tried to radio base. He couldn't because he had lost his voice. His throat was very dry. His trousers were torn. His clothes were muddy. He had a nasty graze on his forehead and under his chin. He had to walk back to the little village of Deans, which is near Livingston, as he had reversed his truck into a ditch. Couldn't get it out. And his wife, when she saw him, went, "My God, Bob, what have you done? Look at you. You're all muddy. Your clothes are torn."
Yeah.
And to cut a very long story short, they called the family doctor. And because it was an assault, the police became involved. They fenced off the area. And the forensic chaps investigated the trousers. And a lovely guy by the name of Lester Nibb, he said that these trousers were not ripped by any forest debris, like sharp twigs, sharp stones, barbed wire. They were pulled upwards in a mechanical manner. And it's a case, as I say, it stands the test of time.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, it was quite exciting, Malcolm, when you produced, because obviously you are now the guardian of those trousers. And I was absolutely taken, as strange as it sounds, to be that excited about a pair of trousers. it was quite a weird situation to be able to actually physically hold something that, you know, has gone down in the annals of British ufology history. They're in remarkable condition, to say how old they are and what happened to them, and the fact that they'd, you know, been examined by the police.
Yeah, that's right. I've still got them in my possession, and I often say that it's like the Turing threads of ufology, you know. And I wouldn't part with them for the world. I've been asked to, you know, I've been offered several hundred pounds to for people to buy them, but I wouldn't do that. But yeah, I take them on lecture tours and stuff, and it's always nice for Joe Public to have a wee look and touch something that was involved with a close proximity sighting. It gives him, like your good self, Paul, that opportunity to at least touch these fabled trousers and take it from there, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I've always found it, I've spoken to several people, Malcolm, and for me it's quite interesting that end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, it seemed that a whole range of strange phenomena seemed to occur across the British Isles, because you obviously had the Bob Taylor incident, you'd got the Enfield poltergeist coming to an end at the same period, and then obviously the following year you've got the whole Rendlesham flap, Alan Godfrey's incident, and then obviously the UFO hotspots of the Peak District, and obviously up in Scotland, Bonnybridge.
Yeah.
Do you not think it's, I mean, I've always found it really perplexing that we seem to have this perfect storm of Fortean phenomena that all seem to arrive at the same time. For me, as a young man, that's the kind of point in my life that I can say, well, that's when I became really interested in this subject. Have you ever kind of considered the weird coincidence of it all seemingly starting at once?
Oh, there seemed to be some semblance of reality in that, because that particular area, for at least 5 or 6 years, period in time, did indeed hold a lot of paranormal phenomena, both on UFOs and ghosts and poltergeists, etc. And many researchers, including myself, are accepting that these UFOs do indeed come in waves. Whilst you do get the sporadic UFO sightings, they seem to be maybe every 10 years, or some people would say 7 years, that you get a big influx. And there's certain locations throughout the world, the Pennine District, for instance, in England, Bonnybridge in central Scotland, and Gulf Breeze, Pensacola. Yeah. There's quite a number of these window areas where we seem to have a concentration of UFO reports. The big question is why? I mean, what is it? Is it ley lines? Is it this? Is it that? And I don't truly know. I don't profess to know why that would be. But there's certainly no denying that they come in waves and peaks and troughs where we have these sightings. And it's interesting that the paranormal seems to be in with that, you know, in with those kind of yearly visitations as well. And I've noticed that in my own research that we have this this thing, you know. So it is quite puzzling, yeah.
I mean, poltergeists have always been the one thing I've gravitated to. I just find the whole situation extremely fascinating, Malcolm, because there's been so many well-recorded, I mean, well, not so many, because that makes it sound quite common, when in reality, extreme poltergeist cases are very rare, and we're very fortunate in this day and age that we're able to look back on some very well-known cases. I've always been perplexed by the whole poltergeist situation, because I can't simply accept the sceptical view that it's just teenagers mucking about.
Absolutely, I mean, that's absolute rubbish for me, because people say, I don't want to get angry at that, people say that it's all pubescent teenagers going through the change of life, they're reaching puberty, and it's all this excess sexual energy, it's thrusting itself into bedrooms and moving things about. What a load of rubbish, because if you look at all the teenagers in, here in the UK, who are going through puberty, there should be hundreds, if not thousands, of poltergeist cases. So I don't accept that it's all sexual energy at all, you know. I mean, we have some wonderful cases, the Enfield poltergeist. For me, the best English case, and the Pontefract poltergeist as well, let's not forget.
Yeah.
But one of the most best cases is certainly the South Shields poltergeist. That is an enormous case, and a wonderful book by Darren Ritson about that as well. Scotland, we have the Sauchie poltergeist, which is near Alloa in central Scotland. I've written about it in one of my previous books, but my next book project will be solely about that case and that case alone, because it has the hallmarks of not just localised in a person's house, it followed the little girl to school. And so that's what's terrifying about it, you know.
Yeah, well, I know you touched on that at the end of your lecture, and I was very excited to hear that was going to be your next project, Malcolm, because, you know, with the greatest respect, it's not a case I know that much about personally.
Well, are you sitting comfortably?
Always, Malcolm, always, fire away.
Well, it was way back in the 60s when 11-year-old Virginia Campbell lived with her family in Donegal in Ireland. And then on one occasion, the family says, right, we're moving to Scotland. And little Virginia didn't want to go. All her family, her friends were there. Her little dog Toby was there. Her school was there. But they had to, you know, they had to do what their parents said. So they moved to this small town or small village called Sauchie, which is near Alloa in central Scotland. And no sooner had they arrived in Park Crescent, that's the name of the street, when strange things started to unfold. There were knockings and rappings on the wall. There was a heavy linen chest which contained family bedding, started to rise up several inches off the floor and move back down. Anytime little Virginia came down the stairs, it was like a heavy bouncing medicine ball went boom, 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 would fall behind her. But there was nothing there. Things would disappear, lights would switch on and off. And it got so bad that they called in the local doctor. And he saw one evening when Virginia was lying in her bed, the pillow next to Virginia said, press down, as if an invisible head had just moved and made a head-shaped depression in the pillow. And then there were knockings and rappings on the wall as well. This is where it gets bizarre, because it even followed her to school. And on one occasion, and back in the 1960s, the classrooms were over 50 kids were in a class. And so this particular occasion, all the class were writing on their, you know, jotters, busily writing away. And Virginia was trying to press down with her forearms on her desk, the lid of the desk. And the teacher went, "Virginia, what are you doing? Stop that. Stop that now. Leave your arms." So Virginia took her arms away from the desk lid, and the desk lid started to flutter, bang, 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 up and down, up and down, up and down, in front of full view of all the classmates. Oh. On another occasion, Virginia went to the teacher. The teacher, obviously, her desk was at the front of the class, massive big wooden desk, and Virginia approached it slowly with her school essay and put it firmly down on the desk of the teacher, and she says, "That's my essay, miss." And just then, a big cane, because back in the 1960s we had the blackboard and a school cane, was lying flat on the table. It started to vibrate, 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 and then it started to stand up, thump, 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 thump down on the table. And then if that wasn't bad enough, the table, the school teacher's table, this big, big oak table, started to rise up about an inch or so from the floor and turn round and swivel. Whereas before, the teacher's stomach was in the main part of the table, it was now at the sharp end, i.e. the narrow end of the table. Yeah. And at that point, the whole class erupted in screams and ran for the door. And it was like one of those cartoons where all the kids are getting jammed in the door because they can't get out at once. And so, as I say, and the local bishop became involved, local priest, I should say, and it went global, not just in Scotland. It went through the UK and then all over Europe, and it went all over. It was a massive case for Scotland. And funnily enough, my mother stays across the road from that house right now here in 2019. She's lived across with that house for about, 15 years or so now. Some case that. So there's a lot more to it than that, but I'll be going into it in greater detail in the book.
Fantastic. So when are you planning to have that released, Malcolm?
Well, I'm not going to be starting working it, and certainly until maybe December, January, and so probably I would say May, June, and 2020 would come out, I would imagine.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Look forward to that. I mean, it's. The dancing stick is always a kind of perplexing phenomenon in this, because there's a case from the late 60s here in South Yorkshire that happened to in a pub in Barnsley, where a young chap was quite ill and ended up being bedridden for a considerable period of time, and he ended up sort of attracting a walking stick that seemed to perform for people and hunt, you know, because it was above a pub, lots of the regulars would go up and apparently this stick would perform for them, Malcolm, and dance about and play tunes.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, nothing really surprises me now, because I think I've heard it all. Probably not, of course, but you think you have in something like, I mean, I've not heard that story, but that wouldn't surprise me. But if that was coming to me as a research group, first off, then obviously, like any researcher, you have to find out what is behind it. Who's the guy who owns the stick? Where's the history of the stick? What's going on here? And you have to dot the I's and cross the T's, because any researcher, and I'm sure you know this yourself, Paul, we have to find out what is going on with any particular case. Try and get a natural explanation. And that's what we do. Even here at SBI, even though I believe wholeheartedly in life after death and being visited by aliens, etc., I'm still bloody sceptical. Every case I go into, sceptical as hell, you know, really are.
I think that's what's always key in any kind of paranormal investigation is because I'm sure we're both very well aware that sometimes. It's packaged as entertainment and shocks and screams, whereas as if everybody, as soon as you walk in, right, well, it's definitely haunted, and we're not going to look for any kind of rational explanation. It's straight to the paranormal, which
I find quite frustrating, because for me, I think you've got to attack it from a sceptical angle to then understand just how strange this phenomena is.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, obviously, we work extensively with the media. The only reason we do so is because there are many people out there, Mrs. Jones, Mr. Smith, are in their little council house. We have an amazing story to tell, but they never want to tell it for fear of ridicule. And then occasionally, if they see something in the paper, they'll eventually go, I might get in touch with that fella Robinson. I might get this off my chest. And this is why we work with the media. We're trying to reach these people who have got a story to tell. And I dare say, for every two people has put their hands up and said they've saw a UFO, there may be five or six behind them and said, well, I'm not putting my hand up. Yeah. No way will I admit to that. And so maybe the UFO phenomenon, well, not maybe about it, the UFO phenomena is definitely bigger, larger than we can ever comprehend, for simply because of the people who don't come forward with their stories, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's always I found fascinating about the Bonnybridge flap, is that it encapsulated a wide variety of people from varying backgrounds, ages, professions, who simply could not comprehend what was going on in the skies above their area.
Yeah, I mean, Bonnybridge was certainly a... Well, where did you start with that one? It was certainly a massive big part of my life, and played a mega part of my life when I lived in Scotland. And it was pleasing to know that it was dealt with not just by me, of course, but by a local councillor by the name of Billy Buchanan. Mm. And his constituents were coming to him saying, look, nothing to do with a broken fence, nothing to do with a burst water main, but we've seen things in the sky, and we need someone to really take us seriously. And rather than scoff, Billy recognised, well, he knew some of these local guys. He went, they're not telling me lies. Mm. Yes, okay, let's look at this. And he was so happy when I became involved, just to add a wee bit of weight to find this. And then when we started to hold public meetings, initially in the Norwood Hotel in Bonnybridge, which was absolutely rammed, jam-packed with people, yeah, prepared to talk about what they saw. And then we did one in Falkirk Town Hall with, I was speaking, as was Philip Mantle, and we had rock group CE4 perform their wonderful music on stage. That was over 800 people, with about 200 to 300 people locked out. They couldn't get in.
Yeah.
That was in the big heady days, 1994. But you're quite right, Paul. Yeah, there was young children, there were middle-aged people, there were police officers, there were bankers, there were lawyers, there were people from all walks of life seeing things. And we had to whittle it down and find out if it was just shooting stars, satellites, what were they seeing truly. We, as a society, we did a number of sky watches in the Bonnybridge area, up on the moors behind Bonnybridge, because you've got these moors that sit further up and look down on the town. So it was a wonderful peace and quiet. I remember one time we had about 30 cars all parked up in the moors, and this shape came bounding down this farm track. And eventually, when it came towards our torches, we saw that it was a big woman, a big, jovial, fat woman, and she says, hey, what are you lot doing here? Get off my property. So you get a laugh. You get a laughing joke at these things, you know, you really do.
Yeah.
And but yeah, Bonnybridge is still ongoing, probably not as big as it was then. Mm. And but it was just interesting that we had the opportunity by many people to look at what was going on. Myself and Billy Buchanan went down to 10 Downing Street a number of times with petitions signed by the local people to try and get open a government inquiry into the UFO sightings in Bonnybridge. We did it with David Cameron, Gordon Brown, and all the other prime ministers. And the tired old statement came back from Downing Street and Whitehall, and that was, as these objects do not constitute a threat to the defence of the United Kingdom, the British government will not seek to undertake any inquiry into what's going on in Bonnybridge. And the sad thing is, Paul, we were so angry and upset about this because we're not talking about things away in the distance. Some of these sightings were so low you could have thrown a stone at. And and if they're not interested, then there's something far wrong. But of course, we can say maybe they are interested. Maybe they are clandestinely interested and doing it covertly.
Yeah, I mean, it's been remarkable, I think, over the last couple of years, especially since, obviously, the article that appeared in the New York Times, co-authored by Leslie Keane, that came out sort of December 2017, where they'd uncovered that regardless of what the US government had been saying for the previous 20, 30 years, they had continued to investigate UFOs despite all public denouncements to the contrary.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, that's a good thing. With the declassification of the files initially in America, we clearly saw that the FBI, NSA, and various other agencies have actively been involved in the study of UFOs. And here in the UK, we've been drip-fed those reports as well, which is great. But there's quite a lot of heavily blacked-out paragraphs. And now, whilst I accept that some paragraphs may contain the witness's name and address, that's fine. Yeah, let's black that out, of course. But not when you look at some of these documents, Paul, there's page after page after page. It's all blacked out, big paragraphs. Now, what's the point in releasing these files to the public and you've got it all blacked out? I really don't understand that. There's something behind that black text, the black cover up. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the term redacted is the bane of any investigator's life, I would suggest.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it seems for us that are interested in these subjects, Malcolm, I think we're about to enter a new age of not necessarily disclosure, but it seems that the average person in the street seems more aware that there is more to this subject than, you know, the previous condescending descriptions of, you know, tinfoil hat wearing nutters and people with very vivid imaginations, Malcolm. It seems that, you know, especially in America, these incidents have been taken by, you know, extremely experienced people in the military and government who are, you know, obviously part of the To the Stars Academy, I think, is probably the most famous collection of them. It's remarkable that it seems to have gone full circle over there.
Yeah, it has. I mean, I still wear my tinfoil hat. You know,
nothing wrong with that.
Folks, only joking. No, I mean, you're right. I mean, back in the day, there were only a couple of TV channels, and your younger listeners won't remember that, of course. And when we did have UFO programs on it, they were very, very, very biased, leaning towards, well, a lot of rubbish. Thankfully, we're in a day and age now with satellite TV and program makers who give us the opportunity to look at both sides. And that's the beauty of it. And then we can present our own facts and findings and leave it to the watching audience to decide. America, yeah, I mean, back in the day, they had the contactees, the abductees, the George Adamskys, etc., etc. And as a young boy growing up, I started to read the books, George Adamski and stuff like that, and it was very flowery, for want of a better word, very interesting for sure. And again, it just opened up my eyes to the possibility that, hey, wait a minute, maybe there is more to this UFO nonsense than meets the eye, because people are claiming to be abducted. And then I started, as I grew older, to try and find books about these abductions, the Betty Andreasen, various other, Betty and Barney Howe. There's so many. And it started to be a storyline. And then we had, of course, the Greys, the Nordics. And I've never, in all my research days, had any dealings, any reports. Well, I have had reports of reptilians, but I've never researched them. I've never came across that personally. And that's not to say I'm not disinterested in that. I am, but I've only ever researched cases coming to me of these small grey creatures. And it makes you wonder because, you know, there are many species here on planet Earth. Admittedly, human beings are all more or less the same shape, although they are, the head, the two arms, the legs, colouring may be different, you know, black, white, yellow, etc. So who's to say that maybe out in the vastness of space, in the cosmos, they are indeed other life forms inhabiting those worlds with different shapes based on the pressure of that environment, you know, the gravity, etc. So there's a lot to take on board, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you consider the acceptance that, you know, the vast size of the universe and the wide variety of scientific and chemical situations out there, it seems implausible that if we have got populations of aliens out there, that they all transcend or fit into what we accept life to look like, Malcolm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people say to me, well, I really don't believe in UFOs, there's no real any substance to it. And I'll say, okay, you're entitled to your views. How did you reach your views? Did you study extensively over 20 years? And then they generally say, no, I just think it's rubbish. And it annoys me, you know, because it is a minefield out there. There's so much disinformation out there. And when we had the press club, the disclosure back in the early 2000s, when we had all these military personnel, the Air Force, the military, the Navy, and they all sat and they all put their hand up and they says, you know what, here's what I saw. And I went, yes, here we go, this is it. And it was yesterday's news. It's like turning over a page of a newspaper. It was gone, forgotten. It didn't make the big splash that people like me and others thought it would do. And, I mean, is disclosure coming now? Is it going to come in the next 5 to 10 years? I really don't know. There is an agenda for sure behind these wee buggers, these wee guys. And I truly don't know what it is. And I've said many times on stage to audiences that if they are collecting genetic material like sperm, ova, etc., then they've been doing it now for over 50, 60 years. Surely they've got enough genetic material to repopulate any dying planet. It sounds bizarre.
Yeah, it is. It does seem to suggest, you know, perhaps have they been extremely careless with it and lost it? Or because, like you say, surely there comes a point where they've probed as many people as they need. I mean, how much more do they need to know?
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, the other avenue of thought is maybe that it's not so much the genetic material, it's maybe they're trying to understand what is the makeup of our soul. I've heard that from some researchers. Maybe they're looking at the soul simply because they don't have them. It's all speculative. There is no, at the moment, any true answers. For me as a researcher, all I can safely say is, for me personally, the evidence that I've amassed, researched, investigated and thrown away, etc., clearly shows to me that we are dealing with a non-human agency. It's always been with us through time immemorial. We see it in the Renaissance paintings. We see it in rock carvings in Australia, etc., etc. So it's always been with us. And I've said to audiences before, for me, just me, I don't think we had help building the pyramids. We don't give enough credence to our fellow man. He had no TVs, he had no cars. He just had himself and the lay of the land and his knowledge how to work the land, etc. I might be wrong. Maybe they did. But for me, I can't see any alien technology giving us a wee hand up on that.
No, I must admit, I'm of the same train of thought, Malcolm. I think we do a disservice to some of the great civilizations because, you know, people always, as you refer to there in regards to the Egyptians, they focus on the pyramids and seem to completely ignore the vast scientific and ecological systems that they set up. I mean, they irrigated the entire north of Egypt using the Nile as a form. They were able to, you know, traverse the whole area and in ships that were completely ahead of their time. That, you know, they were a vastly intelligent civilization, not just, you know, based on just a group of pyramids just outside of Cairo, are they?
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Yeah, that's true. And there was many camp settlements for the thousands upon thousands of workers who were there, who helped build the pyramids as well. So we have, all, as you say, we have all that evidence there to say that it was a massive feat of engineering for sure. Really incredible. And then, of course, we have the Mayan pyramids as well. And they're not denying that all these different races, Kaiser Koto, etc., claimed that he saw things falling from the sky. During many battles back in ancient times, they saw these, they called them flying shields. Today we would call them UFOs, of course. We had the Scandinavian ghost rockets, and we had the Foo Fighters, we've had the scare ships. So it seems to, the phenomena seems to have changed over the years. It seems to get more technological, you know. I mean, the fairies of yesterday are now the aliens of today, these, you know, these little creatures. So things are evolving. But for me, if I had to nail my colours to the mast, it would probably be that planet Earth is but a zoo, and maybe we were seeded here by these beings as some form of experiment. And they're just, these sightings, these abductions are just nurturing us, you know, looking us over, trying to change us. But again, it's been too long in the making. There should be a final agenda now, you know, and that kind of worries me as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was watching something the other day, and I think it was the To the Stars Academy show, which basically one of the American government officials who's now part of that organization was saying they've got to come to some decision now, whether it's, is it in, are they Independence Day or are they ET? Which way are these phenomena going to go from this point on? Because clearly a lot of people are starting to drift towards the hostile aspect of this, I think.
Yeah, and we'll have to be careful of that, of course. And let us not forget, mankind has been putting radio signals out into deep space for quite a number of years now. And because we're through the Arecibo telescope and etc., we're trying to point our dishes at deep space to try and get signals coming back. And we've had the famous WOW signal, of course. And there was something in the newspapers the other day about some strange signals coming from space. It could be just be clutter. It could have natural explanations. But getting back to your point, yeah, what are we truly dealing with? Are we holding our hand out here and it's going to be bitten off? Because not only these little guys are friendly, some of the abduction reports that you and I, I'm surely know, are not so nice. And that's the problem. And we have to be very careful what we're dealing with here.
I mean, Stephen Hawking famously said, you know, he thought it was probably the worst thing we could possibly do was to basically you know, put our hands up and go, hello, here we are, come and see us, because he just said you've no idea what you're encouraging to come.
Yeah, I mean, when mankind back in the early days went over to Australia, the Brits went over to Australia. They colonised and treated the Aborigines very, very, very badly. When we went into the Amazon rainforest about 50 years ago, we met these tribes and changed basically their lifestyle. They're going about drinking Coca-Cola now and wearing, you know, Nirvana T-shirts. So we've impacted on their culture. So it would be interesting to find out what if, well, it would be a change. I was going to say, what if anything happened if they said they were here? Of course, there would be massive changes. We look at the Christianity, we'd look at the church, we look at religion. How would that change religion as well? And would they, you know, destroy cities, or would they just give us medicine to cure cancer, etc., etc.? It's a potpourri of speculation, but there certainly would be a massive change. Would it be swinging to the left or swing to the right of how good that would be for mankind? That's open to question.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I've always found that weirdly. It's part of humanity's arrogance, I think, Malcolm, especially when you talk about some of these remote tribes in, you know, still in the Amazon basin and things. As people seem to think that these people want us to come and flog them crap, you know, and for me, you know, these people have clearly been there for hundreds of thousands of years with little need for the outside world. It baffles me as to why people feel the need to harass these people more than anything.
Yeah, that's just typical mankind, and we do it to our own selves, i.e. Hitler invading Poland, Czechoslovakia. Mankind, as we all know, is a nasty son of a bitch. Yeah. And there doesn't appear to be any stopping the desire to control other people. I don't think that'll ever happen. You know, sadly, I wish it did. Wouldn't it be great to live in a world where everybody gets on? I mean, knife crime in the UK is rising. Where the dwindling police force resources are, they're taking police officers off the street. Okay, that's going down a different avenue now, but you can see that right now, you know, things are changing with society, etc. Yeah. But we'll always have a UFO phenomenon.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, obviously at the moment, probably the most notable window area, as they're known, is obviously what's going on the east coast of England, that Paul Sinclair and Bob Brown are involved with. For me, I think it's quite interesting because, you know, as we touched on earlier on with some of the flap areas that we've had in the past in the UK, Malcolm, it seems to have been probably the most well-recorded window that we've had over a considerable period of time, because Paul's on the ground and he's doing this as it happens, as it were.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, what Paul Sinclair and Bob Brown's doing right now in that area is truly tremendous. I mean, there's clearly some form of flap going on there. There's a phenomena occurring there. And I think we should be there, you know, people like your good self and me and other researchers should be there having a wee look at this as well. But clearly the phenomena that's ongoing in that area deserves more attention. It certainly deserves more media attention to wake up the people who scoff at these matters. I've attended a couple of Paul's lectures in the past where he's talked about these things, and you can clearly see that this is real. Yeah. It's a genuine phenomena. It's not wishy-washy. It could be, maybe. It's none of those things. It's something as yet unknown, and I look forward to finding out where all this ends, if it ever does.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of it that's reminiscent for me of a couple of other areas where we've had a whole range of paranormal phenomena. It's not just UFOs. You know, you think of perhaps in the States, Bridgewater Triangle's probably a very well-known window area where you've had a whole range of phenomena, both on the ground, you know, you've got hauntings, you've got alleged cryptid sightings, as well as strange lights in the sky. And it seems to be a very similar thing to that, and as well as, you know, what was going on at Point Pleasant, which John Keel wrote about. It's very reminiscent of those two particular areas for me, Malcolm.
Yeah, definitely. There is a lot of similarities in the cases you spoke about. Certainly the Point Pleasant Mothman sightings that John Keel wrote about were quite perplexing as well. And I think Jonathan Downs speaks about a kind of owl man or something he already has done in past years. So there is some strange creatures ongoing here in the United Kingdom. And I mean, obviously we have Nessie, of course. And what we have to bear in mind is that there's many species of insects and animals being discovered on a regular basis here on planet Earth. So that, you know, frogs, insects, new species are being found every day. So people shouldn't scoff at these things being found. And I'm referring, of course, to these lake monsters, loch monsters. I'm not saying there's any remnants from the Jurassic or Triassic period, not at all. But clearly there's something in Loch Ness and Loch Morar and Ogopogo in Canada, another Lake Okanagan. Yeah. There's a number of these areas. And people, getting back to this point again, people have speculated, well, maybe, just maybe, it's not a flesh and blood creature. It could be some thought form or some ghost or something, you know, that's just suddenly appearing. Because when we look back at the Bob Taylor UFO, it disappeared, it reappeared, it disappeared, it reappeared. So maybe there's something going on there that Bigfoot, Sasquatch, they may not necessarily be flesh and blood creatures. And yes, I admit there are footprints in the snow, but they could be something else entirely. And that's the fascination, that's the wonderful thing about being a researcher, is because we try to look straight. We should look left and right and above the box and over the box. And I don't think we do enough looking over that box. They see what's in the corner. Sometimes we just, as human beings, we think it's just so straight-laced, but it's not all the time. It's maybe in a totally, totally direction of what we think it is.
Yeah. I mean, is it? I mean, obviously, as well, I've fortunately spoken to a lady called Katie Elizabeth, who essentially is living at Lake Champlain in New York State, because she's relentless in her search for their lake monster champ.
Oh yes, yes.
And she's ended up just in the last week or so capturing some really interesting sonar images, because she's out on the lake as often as she can, and it's caused quite a flap because she's clearly caught something rather large underwater.
Wow. Yeah, I'd be interested to see that footage for sure.
Yeah, I'll send you the link afterwards, Malcolm, because she's, like I say, she's been fortunate enough to have her on here, and hopefully she's coming on again soon to talk about these results. But I'll send you a link to the article and you can have a look at it.
Yeah, definitely.
So, obviously, as we've mentioned, Nessie is probably the most famous lake monster in the world, and we're currently all waiting with bated breath this result of these DNA tests that have been continually mentioned over the last few months. Have you any sort of thoughts in regards to the whole Nessie phenomenon, Malcolm, as a cultural phenomenon, or do you honestly think that there is a lot more to it than it's just a way of dragging people to the north of Scotland?
Well, it certainly does that as well. I mean, let us not forget, people can make money out of anything. We have Elvis Presley Boulevard, where it's just a lot of trinket rubbish up and down this boulevard before you get to Gracelands. There's various locations starting to make money out of various phenomena, and we're talking phenomena here. And I guess Loch Ness, your degree is not any different. Admittedly, we have a lot of trinket shops, etc., selling Nessie souvenirs surrounding Loch Ness at Drumna Jocket, at Fort Augustus as well. And fair play, you know, at the end of the day, people have to make a living. And but getting back to the gutsy part of Loch Ness, for me as a researcher going up with this as a wee boy visiting, it's one of my favourite places on this planet. I just love the atmosphere and mood of being at Loch Ness. And I do honestly believe that we're dealing not, of course, with one. That'd be silly. We're dealing with at least six, possibly more, objects, creatures, call them what you will, in excess of 30 feet. And the best evidence for Nessie is sonar evidence. And back in 1987, Operation Deep Scan, that was a flotilla of about a dozen or more small boats, fishing vessels. Well, not so much fishing vessels, just the normally little boats with the best sonar evidence or sonar devices on each of these vessels. They traversed the loch up and down for a number of days, and they managed to capture about half a dozen strong sonar contacts, which were not a grouped shoal of fish. The problem we have at Loch Ness is many people come over from various parts of the world for about 5 minutes, and they're driving along the road, and they look, and all it is a standing wave. We have a number of boats traversing the loch, going south and going north, and when the bow of that boat creates a standing wave, it meets the other standing wave of the other boat, and you have this what appears to be a big hump or several humps. And it looks absolutely, yes, of course, it looks very strange and bizarre, and it looks like the back of a creature, but it's not. And so people are more probably misguided at Loch Ness than UFOs or ghosts. And I've never said that before, but I think there are more people fooled by the various weather conditions, wind phenomena, things happening on the loch, than any other phenomena we're dealing with. And as you know, I was very fortunate to go down in the Loch Ness submarine back in 1994. We went to a depth of just under 500 feet, and that was an experience I'll never forget. It was wonderful, wasn't it? Yeah.
I mean, I've been fortunate enough to visit Loch Ness, Malcolm, a few years ago. And it is just an incredibly beautiful part of the United Kingdom. Anyway, it's I was lucky enough that it was during the heat wave of 2003. So the weather was absolutely fabulous, and it was just like as the saying goes, it was a picture postcard scene. It was just jaw-droppingly beautiful, regardless of all, you know, the Nessie phenomenon. The whole area itself, it's just a fabulous place to go and spend some time. I found it quite therapeutic, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there many times, and as a young boy and then a teenager, I interviewed a number of witnesses who live around the loch. I'll give you a couple of quick for instances. Interviewed Father Gregory Brucey from the Benedictine Abbey at Fort Augustus. Well, it was an abbey then, it's not now. They've turned it into flats, sadly. Now, this is a man of the cloth. Now, obviously, police officers can lie. I dare say that the men of the cloth can lie. So let's not put any credence on that. But he was a really sincere guy. And he said that back in 1971, he had a friend from Westminster Cathedral come up from London up to Loch Ness. And I'll cut the story short. He took him down to the jetty at Fort Augustus at the southern side of the loch. And the loch was like a sheet of glass, not a ripple. It was a lovely day. And Father Brucey said to his colleague, well, there you go. That's the famous Loch Ness. Seconds later, this enormous neck and the small sheep-like head thrust out from the bowels of Loch Ness, very agitated, and then plunged back into the depths of Loch Ness. Now, Father Gregory had seen Nessie before a few times, but he's standing there, his jaw's dropping, the other guy's jaw's dropping, and you just could not have scripted it. You could come to Loch Ness every day for the rest of your life and never see anything. Then this guy was up for 5 seconds and bang, he saw something straight away. The other chap I interviewed was Alex Campbell. He was a former water bailiff on Loch Ness. Hmm. And it was this gentleman who actually brought the Nessie subject to the world. Back in 1934, he was a journalist at the Inverness Courier. Mm. And he had a lady who had saw a strange object on the Loch Ness. He interviewed her and he put that story in the paper. And that story went right around the world. Alex Campbell had his own sighting. He said that he saw a long neck, a small sheep-like head and a couple of humps. And it was traversing just slowly across the loch and it just plunged back into the depths of Loch Ness. For me, Nessie is not an air-breathing animal. It's, it only comes up, it's only seen at the surface when it's feeding the fish, which is maybe 6-7 feet below the surface of Loch Ness. So it's coming up and thrusting up and trying to attract these fish, and then it plunges back into the depths of Loch Ness. So that's me. People might think I'm crazy. I probably am, but I honestly believe we have a Nessie there, and well, not more than one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, ever since I was a small boy, it's probably the first monster I ever was ever made aware of, Malcolm. So I think it's something that we all hold dear to our hearts, I think, more than anything. It's as if we've got an emotional attachment with the old girl.
Absolutely. And, you know, if it turns out to be nothing more than a large sturgeon fish or... then fair enough, I'll put my hand up and say, well, it certainly was interesting for all those years. Mm. Because all we, you and I and other researchers are trying to do is just get an answer. Get an answer to what's going on. And if Nessie has, it turns out to be a big fish, then so be it, that's fine. But we just move on, and because that's all we're trying to do. Science is ever progressing. We're learning things every day, you know. Mankind is at the bottom rung of a very long, tall ladder. And with each rung we step up, we're learning something new. Now, whether we get any answers to the UFO enigma in my lifetime, goodness knows. I'm sure that those researchers who have passed off this mortal coil now know the answers because they're on the other side of it. So maybe it's when I go myself, because I do believe in life after death, the evidence is overwhelming. But I guess when I go, then maybe I will have the answers. But at the moment, I don't. I'm not an expert. Nobody is an expert. All we are is just guys who are very intrigued by things that people laugh at.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I'd rather be on your side of the table, Malcolm, diving into these subjects than on the opposite, to be honest, because it's just something I've... it's that thirst for knowledge that's been with humanity for forever, that I think we have to continually keep pushing ourselves to investigate these phenomena and situations, regardless of mainstream science's ban on it, really.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We would love for more scientists to become involved, professors, etc. But the sad thing is, and probably quite rightly, if they start to hang their hat on any of these subjects, their peers will go, whoa, what are you doing? You're not going into that UFO business, are you? So they shovel back, they come back, not them all, but most of them will not get involved with the subject for their peer pressure, and it would destroy their career and stuff like that. And that's a shame. It's a great, great shame, because we'd love more scientists to become involved. And I'm not saying all scientists are like that, of course I'm not. But there is quite a substantial amount who just won't look over the fence. They'll just stay over in their own garden, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame, really, but it is what it is, unfortunately, isn't it?
Yes, maybe that'll change. As I say, I mentioned earlier in the show that years ago we only had a couple of TV stations. It was very bare, thin on the ground about programmes of this nature. But now this is coming out more and more. The success of the X-Files TV show a number of years ago, big blockbuster movies, etc., all are letting the young kids of today just have a wee look and make their own mind about these things. Whilst the internet is a great thing for learning up on these subjects, it also is bad as well, because it's a lot of disinformation. And the technology on these photographs, you can construct a UFO photograph into a family photograph, no problem at all with these apps. And we never had that back in my day, you know, in the 70s. So things are changing, but that said, technology can still be applied, thank God, to have a wee look at these photographs, and by that technology we can determine if it's a model supported by a thin string or a thin wire, etc., or not. So it works both ways, technology.
Absolutely. I mean, before I let you get back to your Saturday afternoon, Malcolm, I know we've touched on poltergeists and things like that, but you've got a wide range of experiences of hands-on investigations of haunted houses. Has anything in, you know, have you witnessed things that just absolutely blew your mind in regards to the hauntings?
Absolutely, and only because I put myself in that ballpark. And it's like, if you go to the hot UFO hotspots, you'll see, well, you should, fingers crossed, you might see something there, but at least you're putting yourself into that arena. I've said many times on different radio shows, I have had my own experiences. I'll be very brief. I'll give you just but two. Probably the biggest one, and the one that really, well, really, really shocked me. You may know it, Paul, but maybe some of your listeners don't. I was asked by a lady to come to her home, and because strange things were happening. And would I like to see ghosts? What a silly thing to say to me, but I wasn't going to turn that down. So, cut a long story short, we went to her house in Chingford, and she took me upstairs, and she took me into one of the little bedrooms, and there was a small wooden dresser thing, only about maybe a couple of feet high, and it had glass shelves on it. And lying on those glass shelves were rings, coins, with little tags on it. And I says, what's that? Oh, that's apports, Malcolm. These are things that fell into the seance room. And when you pick them up, they're very hot. And we've been collecting them, Malcolm, for a good year or so now. Then she took us into the back bedroom where a visiting psychic was. Do you know this story, Paul, by the way?
No, I don't.
No? Okay. Where a visiting psychic would be attending the house in an hour or so. And she wanted me to make sure there were no hidden devices. So I was knocking on the wall to see if there were any hidden hollow sounds, you know, cavities there. Yeah. Checking the floorboards through the carpet, thumping my feet down to see if it made a different noise, maybe a hidden cavity. I was happy that the only thing in that room was a slender, tall unit at the back, which had a small red ambient light on it. There was a small chest of drawers, which was next to this curtain. There was a black curtain going from one corner of the room to the other, just in the corner of the room. Behind that was a chair. Anyway, cutting a long story short, the visiting medium came up. He introduced himself. He was going to go into trance that night. So I said, is it okay to pat you down? Make sure you're not hiding anything, any tricks.
Yep.
And so I patted him down. I was happy. Yep, nothing's there. He sat back in his chair. We pulled the curtain over. And you could see his white socks. He had taken his shoes off. They were sticking under the curtain. Mm. And with myself, there were three other people sitting next to me in chairs facing that black curtain, which he was behind. Mm. And then the lady of the house put the lights out. Our eyes got accustomed to the small red ambient light, which was behind us on another unit.
Yeah.
And then suddenly all these little bells, these little silver bells, small bells that was tacked onto the wall started to ring as if somebody was shaking them.
Mm.
And then all these voices, male, female, young, old, bang, 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 bang. Sounds coming from all over the room, from near your ear, from under your chin, from under your chair, from above your head. Wow. And I turned round thinking, somebody is doing a great job of throwing their voice. Who is it? Now, even though the main light was off in this back bedroom, with that red light, you could still see the silhouettes of the people sitting next to you. So it wasn't pitch dark.
Yeah.
And as far as I could make out, I didn't see anybody's jaw moving or anybody making these. But it was silly anyway, because it was right next to my right ear and under the chair, everything.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, this face moulded into the very fabric of this curtain and pushed itself out into the part in the middle of the room. And you could see the nose, the bridge of the forehead, the chin. What a fright I got, Paul. I mean, I'm going... Now, if he was doing this with a telescopic rod and any props, his feet were still planted on the floor.
Yeah.
Then that came back. And then suddenly the small chest of drawers, which was sitting next to the curtain, started to vibrate. Then it came up from the floor, floated up from the floor, right up towards the ceiling, stopped and moved across towards me, came down and sat on my toes. Now, there were no wires, no trap doors, no nothing. I saw that come over and I really did get a fright. And then this voice, and it all sounds Hollywood, it all sounds crazy, but this voice boomed out across the room. Was Mr. Robinson impressed by this? and it's so crazy, you know. And I said to this imaginary voice, or whoever this voice was coming from, I'd be more impressed if you took it back.
Yeah.
So I did the cardinal sin, Paul. You should never, ever, ever interact or stop psychic phenomena from happening.
Mm-hmm.
More so if you have a psychic who's building this up for it to happen.
Yeah.
So I got my finger on my right hand and hooked it under the top lid of the small three chest of drawers.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, you are, my friend, are going nowhere.
Yeah.
Okay, on you go. Take it away. Come on. And nothing happened for the first couple of minutes or so. And I went, it's not going to go. And then suddenly, you know what's coming? Suddenly the pressure, the tremendous pressure of a pull of a tug from this little chest of drawers on my finger was immense.
Yeah.
Nobody to the left was there. Nobody to the right of it was there. Nobody was standing pulling this. Nobody. And then suddenly I just couldn't hold it back any longer. And it just, my finger just fell away. The chest of drawers rose up into the air of this, into this room, went away back to the far wall and just sat gently down on the floor. And at that point, Paul, a tremendous cold wind pervaded the whole of that room. And it was like as if previously you were maybe lying with just your trunks on in a Jamaican beach enjoying the sun. And then a big hand comes out of the sky and throws you into these big industrial freezers. That's how cold it got.
Oh.
Freezing. I blew out into the air and you could see your breath freezing up more or less. It was that cold. And I'll never forget that. Lots of other things happened that night. And that is one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. Now, sadly, and the skeptics will love this, did I have any evidence? No, I didn't. The lady of the house refused to have my cameras in, my audio equipment in. And that is a lovely story, but no backup, none whatsoever, other than a story.
Incredible, really. I mean, like you say, when you witness something as peculiar as that, even the opportunity of fakery seems to be quite difficult when you're talking about the moving of such an object in a confined space, Malcolm.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget the fact that we have some very, very talented magicians out there. Darren Brown, the illusions, etc. And some of these illusions are terrific. So I'm not so stupid and naive to think that it wasn't some trickery going on here. But if it was, Paul, it was the best I've ever seen, mate. I'll tell you that.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, I think that's a fantastic part to let you go, Malcolm. So thank you again for spending some time with me talking about your career and some cases today. Where can everybody find your books and follow your further investigations, Malcolm?
Well, I'm on Facebook, and all my books are on Amazon and also Lulu. So if you check out Malcolm Robinson on Amazon, you'll see some of my titles. I've now written 7 books, I believe. Paranormal Case Files of Great Britain, Volumes 1, 2 and 3. Yeah. UFO Case Files of Scotland, Volumes 1 and 2. The Monsters of Loch Ness, The History and the Mystery. The Decmont Woods UFO Incident. So, you'll find them on Amazon. And I'm happy to hear from any of your listeners who have their own stories to tell. We'll treat it in confidence and you will get a reply.
Fantastic. And are you still at the... is it malkyspi@yahoo.com, your email, if they want to drop you a line, Malcolm?
That's the one. Yes, that's the one, Paul, yeah.
Perfect. Well, listen, thank you again today. It's been a fascinating opportunity to chat with someone I've got a lot of respect for as yourself, Malcolm. And I was blown away by your lecture at the Outer Limits conference. And I know you were saying on Facebook the other day what's been your favourite conference ever. And obviously that so far is mine because it was my first. So,
right.
So everything's got a high bar after some of the speakers and the talks we had that day. It was a fantastic day.
Yeah, well, Chris Evers should have his own award because he puts a lot into this. It's just a shame we didn't have Calvin Parker there due to ill health. But he's got a lot of good ideas for next year, and I hope they all come through. But he certainly is a wonderful character, as Chris. And as are a lot of people who put on these lectures, because at the end of the day, whilst, again, you can get it on the internet, it's nice to just sit down and listen to the speakers of today about these wonderful subjects. It's great. And the chit-chat afterwards, Paul, is even better.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and it was delightful to see you get an award as well for your outstanding contribution to this field as well, Malcolm. You've been hard at it for a long time, and long may you continue, sir.
Well, we're not in it for awards, as you know, Paul, but it is nice. And Philip Mantle, who also got an award that day, has said the very same. We're not in it for awards, but it's nice to get that recognition. We'll accept that.
Brilliant. Well, listen, once again, thank you for today, Malcolm. It's been a pleasure and honour. And no doubt I will speak to you again sometime, and I'll send you those links we've mentioned later on today. And you enjoy the rest of your weekend, sir.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I wish you every success in all you do there. I really do.
Thank you, my friend. Take care.
Cheers now. Bye-bye.